picture this. You're sitting at your kitchen table. It's late at night, and the glow of your laptop screen is practically burning a hole in your retinas.
Oh, we've all been there.
Right. You're staring at this massive, incredibly complicated spreadsheet filled with property investment opportunities.
Just rows and rows of data.
Exactly. I mean, maybe you're evaluating a 50-unit commercial building, or maybe you're just swiping through a modern platform offering a fractional stake in some apartment block halfway across the country.
Yeah, the scale doesn't really matter.
It doesn't. Because regardless of the scale, you're desperately looking for that one single magic number.
The golden metric.
Yes, that golden metric that's going to jump off the screen, tap you on the shoulder, and say, yes, this is the one. This is the guaranteed good investment.
The allure of that single definitive number is just incredibly powerful. I mean, we naturally crave certainty, right? Especially when we're talking about allocating serious capital.
Oh, absolutely.
This spreadsheet kind of promises this alternate reality where the math just makes the ultimate decision for us. It strips away all the messy ambiguity of the real world.
I have absolutely fallen into that trap, hand on my heart. But, well, the sources we're unpacking today, a really comprehensive guide on property investment metrics, they completely shatter that illusion pretty quickly.
They do, yeah. It's a wake-up call.
It really is. So, welcome to today's deep dive. We all know how to calculate these baseline figures, right? Finding a property with a massive rental yield or a building that boasts, 100% occupancy, feels incredibly reassuring.
It feels like a win before you've even bought it.
Exactly. You see those numbers and you think, okay, I've cracked the code. But relying on one figure like that, just in total isolation, is essentially flying blind.
It really is the equivalent of taking a single snapshot of a moving train and trying to calculate its final destination.
Oh, I like that.
Right, because the numbers provide a momentary glimpse, but they strip away the broader context. Chasing a headline figure without digging into the structural reality beneath it. That's just a fast track to acquiring someone else's really expensive problem.
Which, brings us to the actual mission of our deep dives today. We're going way beyond the basic definitions.
Yeah, we're not just reading the dictionary
Yeah,
here.
no, not at all. If you're listening to this, you likely already know that yield is income over value. Occupancy measures who is actually inside the building. What we're going to do today is decode the actual mechanics behind these metrics.
The hidden gears turning in the background.
Exactly. We want to expose what these numbers are actively hiding from you and how to snap them together like pieces of a puzzle.
To reveal the true operational health of an investment.
Yes. Because treating these metrics as the final answer is, well, it's just totally backward.
They're really simply the vocabulary you use to interrogate the asset. I mean, the metric itself never provides the conclusion.
It just starts the conversation.
Precisely. It only tells you which questions you need to start asking.
I always think of this through the lens of a car dashboard.
Okay, lay it on me.
So, looking at a single property metric is like fixating entirely on the gas gauge. Let's say you look down and see you have a completely full tank. Fantastic, right? You're fueled up, you're ready to drive across the country.
Sounds good so far.
Right. So that full tank is your double-digit rental yield. But if you completely refuse to check the engine temperature gauge, which, happens to be buried in the red because the radiator's cracked, you are not going to make it past the city limit.
The car is going to explode.
Exactly. The gas does not matter at all if the engine block is literally melting.
That's a great way to frame it. The dashboard requires synthesis to be useful. And, in the realm of real estate, the gauge that almost everyone stares at first, the one that totally blinds them to the overheating engine, is rental yield.
The ultimate billboard metric.
Right. It's the quickest shortcut for just racking and stacking 10 different properties side by side.
But our guide today exposes why chasing an unusually high yield is often a massive trap.
It is, because the market is, frankly, ruthlessly efficient at pricing risk.
Right.
When you see an anomaly, like a yield that significantly outpaces the surrounding market average, it is rarely a stroke of unseen genius on your part.
As much as we'd like to think we're just that smart.
Right. We all want to be the genius who found the golden ticket, but high yield is typically just the market's mechanism for compensating the buyer for taking on a disproportionate level of risk.
Let me play devil's advocate here for a second.
Go for it.
Let's say I'm looking at two $1 million buildings.
Okay.
Building A offers a 5% yield, meaning $50,000 a year in income.
Okay, pretty standard.
Right. But building B offers a 10% yield, generating $100,000 a year. The math is just the math. Why on earth wouldn't I just take building B and pocket the extra 50 grand? I mean, I want the higher cash flow.
Well, let's run the actual real-world math on that scenario, because that extra 50 grand, it might never actually materialize in your bank account.
Why not?
Because building B is yielding 10% for a reason.
Ah, a catch.
Always a catch. Perhaps the previous owner deferred literally all major maintenance for the last decade. They know the HVAC system is on its last legs. They know the roof needs a $200,000 replacement next year, and the plumbing is basically failing.
Oh, wow. Hey.
So they are pricing the property lower to get rid of it, and that lower purchase price mathematically inflates the yield percentage.
Oh, I see.
Yeah, so whoever buys it is inheriting a ticking time bomb of capital expenditures.
Okay, I see the trap now. The yield looks amazing on the spreadsheet today, but next year my entire profit margin evaporates because I have to buy a massive new roof.
Exactly, that's one very common scenario. Another major driver for an artificially inflated yield is weak underlying tenant demand.
Like economic issues in the area.
Exactly. The property might be located in a neighborhood where, say, the two major employers are shutting down their factories.
So jobs are leaving.
Right. The seller knows the current leases are highly unlikely to be renewed, or that future rents will have to be slashed dramatically just to keep anyone in the building.
So the 10% yield is just a snapshot of a really fragile present.
It's not a promise of a sustainable future at all.
Wow. Okay, so the higher the yield, the louder the alarm bell should actually be ringing.
Absolutely. If the average in a neighborhood is 5% and you stumble on a 10%, you haven't struck gold. You've just found a mystery you need to solve.
You're basically hunting for the catch.
Yes. Your immediate reaction should be forensic.
What artificial factors are propping this income up, and what is the specific risk the market sees that I'm currently blind to?
That's exactly the mindset you need.
That makes perfect sense. And, you know, this connects directly to the second headline figure. Investors totally obsess over the occupancy rate.
Ah, yes. The pulse.
Right. If yield is the money, occupancy is the pulse. It's the proof that actual human beings or functioning businesses find value in the physical space.
Because rental income can be manipulated in the short term, you know. But occupancy trends tell a much more grounded, stubborn story about the underlying desirability of the asset.
It's harder to fake.
Much harder. It validates the location, the amenities, and the local economic engine.
But the nuance the guide brings up here is, I think, really critical. We tend to view literally any vacancy as a failure.
Right. An empty unit feels like lost money.
But a building sitting at 100% occupancy for a straight decade isn't necessarily realistic or even desirable, depending on how incredibly undermarket the rents might be. Vacancies are just a biological reality of a building's life cycle.
Yeah, the distinction lies in diagnosing the type of vacancy.
Break that down.
So a lease ending naturally, a tenant relocating because they got a new job, or a business just outgrowing its square footage, these are frictional vacancies.
Right, just the normal churn of life.
Exactly. They are healthy. You expect them. The danger is structural vacancy.
Which is what?
This is when units sit completely empty for 6, 8, or 12 months at a time, despite active, aggressive marketing.
Okay, I use a restaurant analogy for this one.
Let's hear it.
So you can walk past a nice bistro on a Tuesday night, and it is packed to the walls. People everywhere.
Looks like a hit.
Right. You might immediately think it is a bulletproof investment. But you have to figure out the mechanics of that crowd. Is it packed because the chef has built a sustainable, incredible menu that drives loyal local traffic year-round?
The structural demand.
Yes.
Yes.
Or is it packed simply because someone rented the entire space for a one-off corporate holiday party,
mm-hmm.
and on a normal Tuesday, the place is an absolute ghost town?
That temporary illusion of demand is exactly what trips up investors who only look at a single occupancy snapshot.
They just see the full house and buy in.
Right. To see the real picture, you have to pull back and look at the historical trend line.
Context is everything.
It is. I mean, consider an apartment complex currently sitting at an 85% occupancy rate. That might look a bit weak on the surface, right?
You want it in the 90s.
But if you look at the broader market and see the local population is surging and a bunch of new tech jobs are flooding in, that 85% might represent a massive opportunity.
Because it's trending upward.
Exactly. You can reposition the asset, do some upgrades, and capture all that upside as the building fills up.
Conversely, you could buy that bistro when it's 100% full, completely ignoring the fact that, historically, it severely struggles to keep the lights on 9 months out of the year.
A flat percentage just tells you nothing about momentum. You have to ask if the building is actively filling up or if it is quietly, steadily emptying out.
Okay, so we've cracked the facade of the headline numbers. We know the yield can totally mask a decaying roof, and the occupancy rate can hide a very temporary spike in demand.
We're past the dashboard now.
We're under the hood. Now we have to face the real reckoning. We have to figure out how much of that theoretical spreadsheet money actually survives contact with the real world.
And our sources refer to this as the danger of a false sense of comfort.
Well, that's a great phrase.
It is, because strong gross rental income is incredibly seductive. You see those large deposits hitting your operating account every single month, and it just feels like the investment is a runaway success.
But those deposits have a target on their back. Before a single dollar reaches your personal bank account to spend, the property has to feed itself.
Right. We are moving from the theoretical gross income to cash flow.
Cash flow. The reality check.
Cash flow forces you to confront the friction of reality. It strips away the gross revenue by subtracting routine maintenance, insurance premiums, property management fees, local taxes, and, you know, the financial buffer you absolutely need for those inevitable periods of vacancy we were just talking about.
Let's make this really concrete with a scenario based on the sources.
Okay.
Imagine two identical brownstone buildings sitting right next to each other on the exact same street. They have the same floor plans, and they both command $12,000 a month in gross rent.
Okay, so to a novice just glancing at the rent roll, these are identical assets.
Exactly. But let's look at the cash flow. Building A is an absolute machine. The owner updated the plumbing 5 years ago. They have a rigorous preventative maintenance schedule, and they use a highly efficient proactive management company.
So they're running a tight ship.
Very tight. Their expenses are low, meaning a huge chunk of that $12,000 flows directly to the bottom line as usable cash flow.
Beautiful. Then look at Building B. The gross rent is the exact same $12,000, but the owner is constantly fighting fires.
Figuratively speaking.
Hopefully. But the boiler breaks down twice every winter, resulting in massive emergency repair bills. Their property manager is totally unresponsive, which leads to angry tenants and high turnover.
Which leads to marketing costs, right?
Exactly. Constant marketing costs and lost rent while units sit empty for weeks.
So even though the gross income is completely identical on paper, the actual cash flow, the real usable money generated, is night and day. Building B is functionally bleeding to death while Building A is thriving.
This specific scenario highlights why cash flow is so vital. But it also opens the door to an even more surgical metric, net operating income, or NOI.
Okay, I'm going to stop you right there.
Uh-oh.
Because this is exactly where my own brain used to short circuit when I first started learning about real estate.
It's a common stumbling block.
Right. If I have already done the grueling work of calculating my cash flow, meaning I know exactly how much money is left over after all the bills and taxes are paid, why do I need another acronym? Doesn't NOI just tell me the exact same thing about my profit?
It's such a common point of confusion because, honestly, they sound totally synonymous, but they measure two fundamentally different realities.
Okay, I'm listening.
Cash flow measures the reality of the investor. Net operating income measures the reality of the building.
Break that down for me mechanically. How could the investor's reality be different from the physical building's reality?
It all comes down to leverage, debt.
Okay.
Cash flow includes your personal financing decisions. Let's go back to Building A, the well-run machine. Say you bought it by taking out a massive commercial mortgage at a really high interest rate.
Ouch.
Right. So every month you have to write a huge check to the bank. Your personal cash flow is going to be incredibly tight, maybe even negative.
Even though the building is run perfectly.
Exactly. Oh. Now imagine I bought the identical, terribly run Building B, but I paid for it entirely in cash. I have absolutely no mortgage. My cash flow is going to look fantastic compared to yours.
So if we just compare our cash flow, your building looks like a genius investment and mine looks like a total disaster.
Right. But that has nothing to do with the buildings themselves. It's just a reflection of our different bank loans.
Oh, okay. That makes total sense.
And that is precisely why NOI is so critical. Net operating income strips away all financing. It totally ignores your mortgage, your interest rates, and your personal tax situation.
It just looks at the asset.
Yes. It asks a pure, unlevered question.
Ah.
If you owned this physical structure free and clear, how much revenue would it generate purely based on its operational efficiency?
NOI is essentially grading the property management and the physical infrastructure on a curve. completely isolated from whatever deal I made with my bank.
It is the great equalizer. It allows you to look at a property that is currently suffocating under a really bad debt structure and recognize that the underlying asset, the NOI, is actually incredibly strong.
The diamond in the rough.
Exactly. Or conversely, it allows you to see that a property generating decent cash flow for a cash buyer actually has a terrible NOI because it is wildly inefficient to operate.
That is a massive, massive distinction. So keeping our car dashboard metaphor alive.
Let's do it.
Yield is the size of the gas tank. Occupancy proves we actually have passengers in the car. Cash flow is the money left in the glove box after paying all the highway tolls.
Right.
And NOI is the diagnostic tool telling us exactly how efficiently the engine itself is burning the fuel, regardless of who financed the car.
That is an excellent synthesis, truly. And, you know, once you have stabilized all of those present-day metrics, once you know the engine is running efficiently today, you have to lift your head up and look at the horizon.
Because nobody builds generational wealth in real estate just by collecting a modest monthly rent check.
Definitely not.
The ultimate wealth builder is capital appreciation. The dream of buying a building today and having the market magically value it at twice the price a decade from now.
But the danger of capital appreciation is treating it like magic.
Right. Hoping for the best.
Or relying on the assumption that real estate prices just perpetually go up no matter what. Experienced investors do not build financial models on hope. They build them on structural, mechanistic drivers in the real world.
And the sources outline a very grounded, practical list of these drivers. We're talking about population growth, infrastructure investment, employment opportunities, and long-term municipal development plans.
Real, tangible changes.
Yeah, but I want to dig into how these things actually force the value of a building up. Let's take infrastructure.
Okay.
If the city council approves a brand new subway line two blocks from my apartment building, why does my building become mathematically more valuable?
It's a chain reaction, and it's rooted right in the metrics we just discussed. A new subway line dramatically reduces commute times, right?
Right. Suddenly you can get downtown in 10 minutes instead of 40.
Exactly. That increased convenience makes the neighborhood significantly more desirable for working professionals. This is population growth meeting employment access.
So the demand to live in my building just spikes.
The demand spikes, which allows you to do two things simultaneously. You can maintain a much higher, more stable occupancy rate, and you can begin to command a premium on rent.
And I can do this without fundamentally changing the building itself.
Correct. You haven't added a new roof or built a swimming pool, but your gross revenue is organically increasing. Assuming your operational costs stay relatively stable, that extra rent flows directly down to your net operating income. Your NOI goes up.
And here's where the math gets really fun. Because commercial real estate is generally valued based on its NOI divided by the market's capitalization rate.
Cap rate, yeah.
So if my NOI goes up because the new subway line allowed me to raise rents, the mathematical valuation of my building is forced upward, literally regardless of what the broader residential housing market is doing.
You have just described the absolute holy grail of property investment. You are securing an asset that provides a reliable, efficient stream of current income, a strong NOI today, but it is situated directly in a geographic path of progress.
The structural catalysts are doing the heavy lifting for me.
Exactly. The infrastructure and the job growth are catalysts that will organically drive your NOI and therefore your capital appreciation higher and higher over the next decade.
So you basically get paid to wait for the property to become exponentially more valuable.
That is the dream scenario.
It is. But, I mean, let's be real. Finding a property that knocks every single one of these metrics out of the park-like, incredible yield, zero structural vacancy, massive cash flow, flawless NOI, and guaranteed appreciation. That's basically hunting for unicorns.
Oh, those properties do not exist. If they did, no one would ever sell them.
Fair point.
Which brings us directly to the metric matrix detailed in our sources. The goal of a sophisticated investor isn't to find perfect numbers across the board. It is to master the art of synthesis.
Putting the puzzle together.
Yes. It is about understanding the inherent blind spots of every single gauge on the dashboard.
And the sources are very explicit about these limitations.
Mm-hmm.
Like, rental yield gives you a snapshot of income potential today, but it is entirely blind to future performance.
Right.
Occupancy validates current demand, but it cannot predict macroeconomic shifts in the labor market.
Exactly.
And the current valuation of a property tells you its market position today, but offers absolutely zero guarantee that those structural drivers for capital appreciation are actually in place.
By layering all these metrics over one another, you expose the specific, unique risk profile of the investment. You might find an industrial warehouse with a fantastic yield, but very limited long-term appreciation.
Or a residential complex with negative cash flow today, but massive appreciation potential because a huge new tech hub is opening up just down the street.
Exactly. The metrics don't just tell you yes or no. They tell you exactly what kind of game you are choosing to play.
Now, this matrix of understanding feels incredibly relevant right now because the way we actually play the game is fundamentally shifting.
The landscape is changing, yeah.
We have been discussing this entire concept as if our listeners, like, gearing up to purchase an entire commercial plaza or a 50-unit complex by themselves.
Which most people aren't doing.
Right. Modern platforms are heavily democratizing this space through fractional ownership.
The barrier to entry has absolutely plummeted. You no longer need millions of dollars in liquid capital to access institutional-grade, income-generating real estate.
But this raises a really vital question for me. If I am sitting on my couch, using an app on my phone to buy a 1% stake in an apartment building in Riyadh, do I still need to sweat all of these complex mechanics?
That's a great question.
I mean, does the fractional nature of the investment give me a free pass on calculating NOI and evaluating all these infrastructure drivers?
Absolutely not. Not even a little bit. The fundamental economics of the underlying asset do not change simply because the capital stack has been sliced into 1,000 smaller pieces.
So the math is the same.
Fractional ownership changes how the deed is legally held, but it doesn't change the physical, operational reality of the building.
It is still a structure made of steel and concrete, sitting on a physical street, subject to the exact same market forces.
Exactly. Whether you own 1% of the building or 100% of the building, that asset still has to aggressively attract tenants. It still has to pay for unexpected roof repairs.
It still has to generate a positive net operating income to actually distribute those dividends to the fractional owners.
The math is completely identical.
Which is why our sources really highlight platforms like Osul Gamma. When you are introducing fractional ownership to a much broader, perhaps less experienced audience, education becomes paramount.
This is vital.
It isn't enough to just offer the slice of the pie. You have to teach the investor how to read the ingredients.
Transparency and education are literally the cornerstones of a healthy fractional market. Osul Gamma's approach focuses heavily on providing everyday investors with the transparent data required to analyze these very metrics we've been talking about.
Giving them the dashboard.
Right. They are building a framework where individuals can evaluate income-generating real estate in Saudi Arabia with the exact same rigorous methodology as a seasoned institutional fund manager.
And it's fascinating to see this ecosystem evolving in real time. The guide specifically mentions that, where applicable, Osul Gamma's fractional offering is actually being tested within REGIA's regulatory sandbox.
Which is a big deal.
It is. It shows a deliberate, very structured approach to integrating these modern investment models into the broader financial landscape.
It is a critical evolution for the market. But even as the technology and the regulatory frameworks advance by leaps and bounds, the bedrock philosophy remains completely untouched. The spreadsheet is not your savior.
It's just a tool.
That's all it is. The most successful investors aren't human calculators who just memorize the NOI formula and run the math faster than anyone else.
Right.
They are pragmatic analysts who understand what the numbers actually represent in the physical world, what they're masking, and how to use them to strip away the illusion of certainty.
So you don't have to be a Wall Street quantitative analyst.
No.
You just have to be a curious, relentless detective.
Yeah.
You have to be willing to look at the full dashboard, recognize when the engine is running hot, and honestly, have the discipline to walk away from a really shiny gas gauge.
Discipline is the absolute perfect word for it.
Which brings us to our final thought for this deep dive. We have spent an incredible amount of time today dissecting numbers, ledgers, and formulas.
We really got into the weeds.
We did. But the numbers can only ever tell you the what. They just measure the symptoms. They can never tell you the why. And that forces us to confront the human element of investing.
The psychological battlefield?
Yes. Think about the playing field today. Every single investor has access to the exact same software, the same historical data, and the same metric matrices we just spent 15 minutes discussing.
The information edge is gone.
Right. The data itself is entirely commoditized. Therefore, your real competitive advantage in real estate isn't found in a spreadsheet anymore. Your true advantage is your ability to conquer your own psychology.
Oh, man. We are remarkably skilled at ignoring data that contradicts what we desperately want to believe.
That is the ultimate danger. How often do our own cognitive biases make us willfully blind? How often do we actively ignore a terrifying trend in structural vacancy? Or just look the other way when the net operating income shows a building bleeding cash through wildly inefficient management simply because that initial headline rental yield looked too magnificent to pass up?
We want the shortcut. We want the easy answer so desperately that we will fabricate a reality where the dashboard isn't flashing red.
But the spreadsheet isn't lying to you. The metrics aren't trying to trick you. You are lying to yourself.
That's a heavy thought to leave on, but it's so true.
It is. So the next time you find yourself staring at that screen late at night, hunting for the golden metric, remember this. The numbers are simply the beginning of the conversation. It is entirely up to you to have the discipline to finish it.
Well said.
Thank you so much for joining us on this deep dive. Keep interrogating the data, check every single gauge on your dashboard, and we will catch you next time.